In the spring of 1985, Bill Maurer was wrapping up his high school education and getting ready to go on to college. And like many students, he was concerned about how he was going to pay for it. His financial aid package was a combination of student loans and work study. But at the end of his sophomore year, he received an unexpected letter in the mail. It said, "Congratulations, you have been nominated for the Hager Scholars Award." And the letter explained that it would take the place of Bill's student loans. And then it explained, it had this simple sentence: "This is an interest-free loan with a moral obligation to repay." At the time, 20-year-old Bill was like, "Well, what the heck does that mean?" "Whatever, I'll take the money." And he was just so grateful that he no longer had a student loan. And so Bill went on to graduate school, became a professor, never received any notices, nothing about that Hager Scholar Award. He paid off his actual student loans, the things they definitely did send a bill for. And after he had paid off all of those student loans, he remembered that Hager Award. And so he went online, tracked it down, and he looked it up. And there it was, that amount of money he had been awarded with the understanding that he had the moral obligation to repay, but never received ever any notice, no bill about. And that line about moral obligation, it hooked Bill. And so he started to repay it. And that Hager's Award made something explicit that we often overlook in the way we tend to think about money. And it overlooks the fact that at its core, money is about human relationships. Bill Maher, he's now the dean of the School of Social Sciences down the road at the University of California, Irvine, and he actually studies the origins and nature of money. And there is a common story we've been told about money and how we humans even created it. And according to Bill, it goes something like this. "In the beginning, if I had something you needed, I would approach you with that thing and see if you had anything I needed. So if you wanted some fish and you needed some almonds and I had them, I could approach you with those almonds and we could barter on the spot, figuring out how many almonds equals how many fish." Of course, the problem with barter is it really does depend on each of us meeting each other's needs in that exact moment. And it requires that we have a coincidence of needs in that moment. You have to have something that I want or need, and I have to have something that you want or need. And so this origin story of money that most of us are familiar with is that humans invented money to be like a mediator for these exchanges. And there's just one problem with that origin story. There's actually nothing in the historical or archaeological record that substantiates it. What is found instead are these systems where people are taking some kind of object. Like a shell or a rock or a plastic rainbow chalice manufactured in China, and use it to mark relationships among people. The shell, the rock, this object served as a kind of indicator of enduring relationships and obligations that people had to one another. It was basically an IOU. And if I gave you this shell, rock, this object thing, and that implies for us, and also everybody around us, that we have a bond. We have a relationship that allows us to take care of one another, to have a flow of goods between our families for the rest of our lives. So it's not so much that I'm giving you this object so that you give me some pigs. It's that I'm giving you this object so that because someday I'm going to need pigs. Some other day I might need your help in the field. And some other day you might need me to help you out with something. The object marked that relationship. It signified to everyone around us that we have ties that bind. As Professor Marr puts it, that these shells, these rocks, these objects were really memory devices to indicate an ongoing, enduring relationship and an ongoing set of obligations. I am going to take care of you, and you will take care of me. I got you, and you got me. The origins of money, as we're familiar with it today, according to this group of anthropologists, actually came about when rulers and colonizers wanted to force people to demonstrate their loyalty to them. And so they created tokens out of precious metal and distributed some of them. And then they said to the people they wanted loyalty from, and something like, in 1 year, you need to give 10 of these tokens back to me or else. So money, as we are familiar with it, really came about because kings wanted to rule and dominate over others. Over the course of the next month or so, a team of some of our most fiercely dedicated church members, they're going to be reaching out and setting up times to talk with you about your lives, about the church, about how the church is or is not part of your life. And yes, at the end of the conversation, members of the church will be asked to make a financial pledge for this next upcoming fiscal year. And people ask, when we did this last year, people asked, why do we put so much energy and time into this endeavor? We could just send you something in the mail to fill out and return. But money can be about so much more than transaction and power. Money can be about relationship and care, just as it was so many years ago. Like that Hager's Award that Bill got, money is about moral responsibility and taking care of one another, of saying, I got you, please get me. In our late stage capitalist world, it's not only money that has been ripped away from relationship. People are being ripped away from each other, from their relationship to the earth and the greater universe. And one of the most important things we do as a Unitarian Universalist religious community is to try to restore that power of relationship where it is being ripped away. Money in this congregation, and at least the boundaries of this community, should never be about exchange and detached transaction. It is always, should always be about care. It should be about generosity, not about how generously, however that looks like for you. In this congregation, our time, care, and labor are not commodities that are bought and sold. This feels particularly precious as the market extends into all parts of our life, trying to make everything something we buy or sell. What we do here is give gifts. And in a gift economy, gifts are not free things like they are out there. The essence of a gift is that it creates a set of relationships and the expectation of mutuality, care, and reciprocity. And so I have a small gift for you all. I realize that some of you, please take one. Some of you may be familiar with the story of the chalice, but I'm going to tell it to you again. I have a couple of boxes of these. Don't worry, I didn't just bring one box. Unitarians, right, came out of the Protestant tradition, out of the Protestant Reformation, and part of that history is that we really were against anything Catholic. That might resonate with a few of you in here. It's okay. No, it's okay. I'll go around. Okay. And part of what is Catholic is ritual. It smells, what we call smells and bells.
And so our ancestors, the Puritans, one of the ways that they decided, and our ancestors, I mean, there's a whole range of folks that can be not Catholic, but our ancestors were like as far away as you could possibly get. And so they didn't want anything that reminded them of Catholicism. And in fact, there's not so long ago in Unitarian churches, there were some churches where they wouldn't even sing songs because that was too Catholic. However, human beings, you may have noticed, we like stories, we like singing, we like symbols. And so our religious ancestors, so not so long ago, Unitarians who had tried to get rid of all kinds of symbols, instead of symbols, we were supposed to focus on the word, on the Bible, purely just be, really get into the word. Pass these around. Well, when World War II came about, a large group of Unitarians created a group that was involved with getting refugees out of Nazi Europe. Oh, hey, there's that connection. What was the story I thought Amanda was telling? Yeah. And they needed to create a symbol that folks could wear and that would indicate to people that they were safe havers, that if you were needing to flee the Nazis, you needed, you know, go follow this symbol. And the symbol that got created, does everyone have one? Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. So they created, the symbol they created was a chalice. Now, there's a mystery as to how this symbol that was created for what was called the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee, so they created a symbol and it was used for that endeavor. But how did it get from that symbol to there? And actually, there's no definitive, we don't actually really know, but the best theory about it is this, which is that in our religious education classrooms, the story was told about the service committee and the Unitarian involvement with getting refugees out of Nazi Europe. And so some creative religious educator or parent decided to actually create a 3D chalice, something that you could light in worship. And then that just spread. There was no dictate from a higher authority. It was through the people and the power of this idea and symbol that now you go into a Unitarian Universalist church, and what do? We light a chalice. This chalice represents a very particular kind of care. And it's the kind of care that we all here are charged with to continue. And I want to say, some of you know, I am not a huge fan of these of fake candles. Yeah. And part of it is I was, because it's always going to be a pale imitation, right, of a real flame. But then I discovered you can turn them on if you haven't already. It's a rainbow candle. And I said, this is really important to me. We should not try to be pale imitations of something we can never be, but instead need to capture our unique gifts. And if we are a battery-powered electronical device and we can do rainbows, then by God, do rainbows. Blessed be, and amen. And we're very fortunate to have Marcia Gilbert and Leo Silvestri, who are some of those fiercely dedicated church members that are gonna be doing a lot of relationship work with y'all, to come up and share a few words.
I'm the Marcia part of that duo. Darcy asked me to talk to you a little bit this morning about why I do this. And basically, she just told you. So I'm going to tell you my story, but only a little bit of my story, and I'll try not to make it 20 minutes long. I've been a member here since 1981, and I was very, very actively involved. I think I served on every committee. I think I held every office other than treasurer, and that's wise. And then it became to the point where if you were the board president, you were everything. There were no committees, there were no other officers that did anything. If you were president, you did everything, and guess who was president? And I couldn't deal with it anymore. It was overwhelming. I was to the point of just, I hated to come to church, and I love to come to church, but I hated to come because I couldn't come to church. I was always being bombarded with somebody needing something. It was horrible, and I left. I left for 5 years. I did not come to church. I did not attend any church function. Nothing. I totally divorced myself, except for my pledge. Every year, I paid the same pledge. And the reason I did that was partly out of moral obligation and moral responsibility, because I am a lifelong Universalist. This is not something new to me. This is where my values were established. My parents were Universalists. My grandparents were. My great-grandparents were. I don't know how many more were. But this is where I learned who to be, who I am, and how to be a decent human being in society. And so after 5 years, I began missing something. And it was you. It was being a part of something bigger than me. And so I came back, but I came back with conditions. And I couldn't say no to people. You know, Marsha, will you do this? Marsha. So I had two men in this congregation who said, send them to us and we'll say no. And they did that for 2 years. I would say, they'd ask me something, I said, go ask Jim. Go ask John. And they would say, no, she can't do that. And then after a while, I began to feel safe. And the minister said to me, will you, if I don't ask you to do anything? That was big. That was really big for me. And she kept her word. She did not ask me to do a single solitary thing. And then I thought about what I could do and what my boundaries were and what I was willing to do. And Darcy will tell you that I will look at her now and say, no, I can't do that. I will look at anyone and say, no, I can't do that. But if it's something I can do, I will do it. And this is something that I can do. I can't do the part of this canvas that Leah can do. And that's why I'm willing to do it with Leah. She does what I cannot do. And I can do a part of it. And so I take on the part of assigning people to come out and visit with you. And we're going to train those people this afternoon. It's a visit. We ask you the same things that Darcy said we're going to ask you. We want to know about you. We want to build a relationship, a one-on-one relationship with you. So that when I come to church that next Sunday, if I didn't know you last Sunday, I've talked with you for an hour in this week, and I will be speaking to you and maybe even hugging you this Sunday. That's what it's about. It's about establishing relationships. And I loved Sue this morning. I said, well, Sue, I put you on my list because I know I'll be able to find you. And she said, yeah, you want to know how much money I'm giving, right? Yep, that's the last thing I'm going to ask about. That's the last thing, and it takes about 5 minutes. And you get to decide. We have some guidelines, but you get to decide. And then we know each other. We, you know, feel good about each other, I hope. It's always worked in the past. And so it's a friendly visit. Nobody's coming to beat you over the head. Nobody's going to pound you with how much you ought to give. Nobody's going to harass you if you don't. You know, we're going to talk with you and find out what's going on with you, and we'll tell you what's going on with us, too. And if you're lucky, I won't tell you that story again.
Hello. Well, it's funny because my story is not all that different from Marsha's story. I joined in 2006 when my daughter was three, and I was looking for a place that would provide her with a more balanced view of things and somewhere besides our home where she could know that we're an inclusive people and not an exclusive people. So I did. I joined her. She would not get off my lap inside the sanctuary for, I think, at least 2 years. I think when she was five, she finally went to CYRE, but not before. So I then threw myself into all things CYRE and children and youth religious education. Thanks, Sharon. Good question. So started facilitating the sessions and getting volunteers and did that for a long time. And then I also left for about 5 years and came back in late 2018, at which time Robbie, our board president, said, "Hey, Leah," I hadn't signed up to do anything yet because I was just trying to acclimate and didn't want to do what I normally do and do too much. So she said, "Hey, Marcia said that she would do pledge for us if you would do it with her." And I'm like, "All right, if Marcia will do it, I'll do it." And so we did it. We kind of created the way that we wanted to do it. In years past, we did mailers and things like that, and we really wanted to bring the human connection to it because that's why we're all here. And we had some training from the UUA or the, I don't know where it came from. We watched some video or some live link. I don't even remember. Some of us did that. And we changed it a little bit to suit our own congregational needs, and off we went. And it went really well. I mean, we had the best annual pledge that we've ever had since I've been here. And it was a fabulous opportunity for us to get to connect with people. My personal mission is about making a positive impact, and I really felt like this church and this committee is a way to do that. So when you get the phone call or the email or the Facebook message or however we can get in touch with you, please just know that our heart is in it and our heart is there to connect with you. One of the things we will be doing at the very end of the visit is asking for your pledge for the next year, but that is only one small part of it because we really look forward to connecting with all of you, and that's why we've agreed to facilitate this committee again this year because we had a blast doing it together, and everybody, all of the committee had a great time, and everybody that we visited with had a great time. So don't run when we call you, please. Thank you.
I'm going to close up with some more words from Dr. Robin Kimmerer.
The market economy story, where everything is a commodity, a transaction, this market economy story that has spread like wildfire, with uneven results for human well-being and devastation for the natural world. But it is just a story we have told ourselves, and we are free to tell another, to reclaim an old one. One of the stories sustains the living systems on which we depend. One of these stories opens the way to living in gratitude and amazement at the richness and generosity of the world. One of these stories asks us to bestow our own gifts in kind, to celebrate our kinship with the world. We can choose. We can choose which story to tell, which story to live. If all the world is a commodity, how poor we grow. When all the world is a gift in motion, how wealthy we become. Blessed be and amen.